right, that was Alternative Radio, presented by David Barsamian. Just one of the dozens, scores of programs produced all around the country and all around the world that your support for KABU helps bring to your into Cascadia for you, all your friends and neighbors to enjoy, to be informed, to be entertained, to become better informed, more fully rounded, more fully human members of your community. During the last few weeks on our All Thrills, No Frills campaign, a lot of you stepped up to be part of that subset of the community that foots the bill to bring everybody KABU. Thank you, every last one of you. And thank you to all the people who gave a little extra to help cover the folks who just don't have the financial space to do so. This is each acting for the benefit of all. This is collective action. This is solidarity. This is Community Radio, KBOO Portland. And now, back to even more of what you have stepped up to support. Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KABU just finished our annual All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign. We want to thank all of our supporters for helping us bring the community engaging, unique, and all-around fun special episodes and killer marathons. We wouldn't be able to do it without our listeners. And if you missed out on any of the programming, you can check out the list of specials at kboo.fm/thrills.
Tune in to Locus Focus, a weekly conversation about our place on the planet, every Monday morning at 10 on KABU Community Radio. Each week, host Barbara Bernstein talks with local, regional, and national experts, activists, and policymakers about climate change, river protection, the transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy, salmon restoration, forest management, and all the other things that are critical to protect our planet. That's every Monday at 10 a.m. on your community radio station, KBOO.
Pacific Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, Biden to Bibi, slow down the slaughter or we won't fill your next weapons orders. Israeli military sacks a couple of officers on the World Food Kill blame game. Also, automated war in the Gaza Strip, 20 seconds to massacre. And deconstructing Warlandia with Arun Gupta, our weekly column covering what the media misses, misunderstands, or suppresses when covering the wars and plunder of exceptional America. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We're coming to you every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network. That's KPFA in the San Francisco Bay Area. We are a free speech, no holds barred, truth to power, non-corporate, listener-sponsored radio network and station. Again, free speech, KPFA, coming to you since 1949. I think that was the year I was born. Anyway, we are happy to have you along today. We are not happy with the news that continues to come out of the Middle East, out of the expanding, and it is an expanding genocide that's including really weapon and starvation as a weapon of war. We've been trying to keep an eye on the story. The corporate media has not. Arun Gupta, welcome back to Flashpoints. The big story in the news is that so-called, I guess it wasn't an accidental shoot down of the World Food Group, but it's reverberating. It's the story of the day. Everybody's upset about it. The president of the United States apparently says if this keeps up, they're going to think about what weapons shipments and they're not going to rush over.
Thanks for having me on, Dennis. And it just keeps getting more and more appalling. And also just there's something that's become revolting about this routine that the media have been engaging in, because, you know, let's not forget that the media have played a central role in this genocide. You know, that Biden is really upset this time. He's really going to issue a hard warning against Netanyahu. Meanwhile, they have already approved $18 billion in weapons. That is a staggering amount. Like, apparently it hasn't been totally decided whether all this is weaponry is going to be released, including 1,800 one-ton bombs, 2,000-ton bombs that serve no purpose in such a crowded area that Gaza was before the war, and much more crowded now that Israel has herded Palestinians into these death zones and turn the entire strip into a death camp. And yet nothing changes. It's all about how angry Biden is, how angry other administration officials are. And now we're even hearing these reports, Jill Biden too upset to do anything to actually stop the U.S. as the primary architect of this genocide, because at any point Biden can say no more, and Israel has to stop. It's all a farce.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And Arun, can you maybe readjust yourself a little bit? I'm not sure the sound is great, and I want to see if we can get a little better sound from you. So everybody's concerned about the World Food Group. Biden's wife is concerned. As you mentioned, they rushed over those weapons, that massive weapon shipment, 1,800, 2,000-pound bombs, and a contract for 50 fighter jets? That's another mystery to me, Arun, because it doesn't seem like we're really getting the reporting about why the U.S. would want to rush 50 fighter jets. It only takes one of those jets 3 seconds to fly over the Gaza Strip. So do we suppose those jets are going to be flying other places? Are we bracing now? We've seen the brazen Israeli attack on the Iranian embassy in Syria. This is like a declaration of war. Israel is expecting, is that what the rush is in terms of the weaponry?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's what it looks like. The fact that Israel went and bombed it an embassy is just extraordinary. And again, it's just basically a blip. And the New York Times, and seriously, their entire editorial team should be at the top of the list in terms of a future Nuremberg trial and in terms of the role they played. They actually had a piece that justified the bombing of the embassy, because it's just like, if they're involved in, like, you know, military planning, then that makes them a legitimate target. Right there, you made every U.S. embassy in the world a legitimate target, because that's what they do. Wherever the U.S. goes, it's full of military assets, full of intelligence assets. And of course, we know the U.S. is involved in wars and coups and destabilizing countries around the world. And so now they're basically saying every single U.S. embassy and Israeli embassy is a legitimate military target. So we have to legitimately wonder what is going on with such a massive weapons shipment. And let's also not lose sight of the fact that Biden has approved over 100 other weapons shipments to Israel in the last 6 months. So every other day or more often, there are more and more weapons going to Israel. And this is the thing, you know, we can talk about the Israeli genocide, but it's really a U.S.-Israeli genocide. Israel couldn't do it without all the U.S. weaponry, without all the U.S. economic aid, because that allows, that frees up their government from spending even more on the military without the U.S. Political support, without the U.S. vetoing resolutions in the U.N. Security Council. And of course, we saw this basically do-nothing resolution a week or so ago calling for a ceasefire. And, you know, unfortunately, I think too many even progressives and leftists fall for this narrative, because I heard people saying, like, finally the UN did something, except UN Security Council resolutions are supposed to be binding, except the U.S. made it non-binding. So yes, you know, they completely undercut any actual power that the United Nations has to say to Israel, this carries the weight of law, international law, and if you continue this, you're in violation of that. It's another instance of Biden being like, I'm getting really angry over here, and you better do something about it. But, you know, I'm going to completely protect your ability to carry out this genocide. And honestly, you know, he is willing to lose the election over this and to usher in fascism, you know, as we've been saying for many months now, you know, to continue the genocide. He's willing to let Trump fascism come to power. That is the state this country is in now.
Now, let's talk a little bit about this really extraordinary story that's breaking out of Israel. It's not being reported in the U.S. corporate press. This is the story that came out of 972. And this is seriously a blockbuster about the Israeli military using artificial intelligence. This is where 22nd decisions lead to major massacres. We're talking about kill lists, over 37,000 Palestinians being targeted. What do you think is happening with this story, Arun? What do you think it means that the Israeli genocide is on automatic pilot and it's not being reported?
Well, you know, I think this has been coming for a long time now. So the article you're talking about is in Plus 972. That's an Israeli-Palestinian online magazine. That's the area code for Israel-Palestine. And it's about this this algorithm. Let's not call it AI. You know, there's no such thing as AI. That's a different story. Called Lavender, you know, and just really kind of an offensive name because that evokes something just gentle and light and summery. And it's basically they created this code to identify possible targets in Gaza. And it is the definition of the banality of evil, because they came up with 37,000 targets. What this freak does is it goes through the whole explanation of how they would decide who the targets were, what the approval process was like. Spoiler alert, there was no real approval process. The humans just acted as rubber stamps The only check they would do was to see if the target was a woman or not. And as long as the target wasn't a woman, then it was approved for a strike. And the strike was on the family home. So when we say 37,000, you have to multiply that by four or five or six people or even more. So we're talking really about hundreds of thousands of targets. And so what the story does is it explains how in many instances the targeting was wrong. And, you know, these intelligence officials who are talking anonymously on background to the reporter saying, like, well, you know, according to our statistics, it was 90% right. But how do you actually even know that it's 90% right? You know, when I saw that, that reminded me exactly what was going on during the Iraq War, the occupation, when Abu Ghraib started to get up and running. The U.S. was saying, well, you know, 90% of the prisoners in there are tied in some way to the Iraqi resistance. And that's what this Lavender program is saying, that 90% of them are tied to Hamas. But it turns out that they could just have the most tenuous alleged connection to Hamas, including being a civil defense worker. And this is according to these Israeli intelligence officials. Who knows, maybe like healthcare workers, maybe teachers are also included. And even they are saying 10% are wrong. But in the case of Abu Ghraib, when the Red Cross actually was able to get in there and the report started to come out, it was estimated only 5 to 10% of the prisoners actually had any connection. So it was 90 to 95%. Only 5 to 10% had any connection to the resistance. And what this sounds like is just a justification for genocide. So they have false targets. There's basically no approval. One of the intelligence officials did say he called them garbage targets because they were low-level operatives. There was no human approval process whatsoever. And then there was another component, again, just these vile names that they give it, called Where's Daddy, that sought to target them when they were home. And in many instances, even their target, who was not even home when a bomb was dropped, and so the family was killed, even without this alleged target being there. And Israel also completely loosened the whatever standards it had for collateral damage, such that it was willing to kill 15 to 20 civilians for a low-level operative. And again, we don't know if that's even accurate or not, and up to 100 for a commander. And we know in the case of the bombing of the Jabalia in the city, you know, what's called a refugee camp, but is basically a small city, that Israel, I think it was in November or early December, dropped a one-ton bomb that killed nearly 200 people, allegedly to get one commander who wasn't even there. So what we have is, this is kind of like the equivalent of the Wannsee Conference in terms of the planning of the Holocaust. And, you know, I think at this point we need to call it the Palestinian Holocaust in terms of what's going on. And now, you know, we have begun the next stage. First was this Holocaust of bombs. And then over the last few months has been this Holocaust of bullets, where there's just, like many of your listeners, I'm sure they've seen just these countless videos on social media of Palestinians just completely distraught, talking about Israeli soldiers invading their homes and then executing family members in cold blood, disappearing other family members, torturing them, sexually abusing both men, women, boys, basically everyone. And I now we've moved on to the next phase, which is the famine of which is the famine phase, and the Holocaust of food and bacteria. Right, that's what people often end up dying from in the famine phase, is opportunistic diseases. And even if there was a massive influx of food at this point, there's still going to be a significant, the death toll is going to still increase significantly, especially among the children, because Israel has completely made, constructed this famine such that in North Gaza, the calorie count is 245 calories per day. That is basically a death sentence. So, you know, we're now 6 months, a half year into this genocide, and it's getting worse.
Has that calorie story, the way in which the Israelis limit the food flow and the calorie flow and time it and is, are purposely moving towards starvation, really sort of not allowing children to have what they need, and thus them sort of not even being able to learn anymore. How is that being reported in the corporate press?
It was just an aside in an article. I don't even remember where I ended up reading it. But, you know, just keep it in perspective. You know, the corporate press, there's a new report out that there have now been over 1,000 documented Israeli attacks on the healthcare infrastructure in Gaza and the West Bank. Over 1,000. And right, and the corporate media still report it. They're still using this offensive phrase, Israel-Hamas war, right? You know, it's no different than during the Holocaust if, you know, they were using, if the media was calling the liquidation of the Warsaw Ghetto, you know, like the German Jewish militia war. That this stuff is just not being reported at all. We've just seen the complete destruction of the Al-Shifa hospital. You know, that was basically a non-story, that over 400 corpses were discovered.
It was a slaughter. It was a two-week slaughter, yeah. at the right. In and around.
And what the world gets worked up about is when 7 white people are killed. Of course, not all of them were white. You know, it was interesting to see all this reporting on the World Central Kitchen, which was completely deliberate. You know, now the reports are, oh, it was a series of errors. You know, but...
This is the point. Let me just jump in here for a second, because this is the point where you were mentioning earlier about it not being AI, and it is reported in the story and the story as artificial intelligence, and it does appear that part of the problem was that this is a system, a structural system that's supposed to be used once you've used all the human intelligence and you've verified everything, this is your check. But this became the main decision in terms of whether an attack would go forward. And according to the technology, you had 20 seconds to determine, and it, so that you know, it didn't have to be anyone in particular that fired on the International Food World Group, because the system is overriding the humans in terms of deciding who dies and when they die, and that's why there are whole buildings, whole families being targeted. I mean, it really does. This is a different kind of killing machine that we're seeing now coming. Really, well, as referenced by the story that isn't in the United States.
Well, actually, you know, that's a great point, because I wanted to point out that the U.S. has been doing this for at least a decade, maybe 15 years. There was this algorithm designed killing program under Obama, our war crime in chief, that was used in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and they were called signature strikes. and it was based on movements of individuals that the machine was computing, and based on how someone was moving around, they would decide that they were a militant. And there was no verification of this whatsoever. And so, you know, if you Google signature strikes, Afghanistan, Pakistan, you'll see these articles about that. And so the U.S. actually pioneered this over a decade ago. And I don't want to say that, you know, this is the future of warfare, because all it really is it's part of warfare, you know, going back thousands of years, that you just assume everyone is the enemy and needs to be slaughtered. This is all just fancy dressing in terms of algorithm and this talk of revolution in military affairs. It's just to sell new products. And of course, that's one of the things going on right now in terms of this war, that we know what Israel does. It has turned Gaza into a laboratory. And right. Again, you know, let's not mince words. The Nazi parallels are out there in the same way that Dr. Mengele, Joseph Mengele, experimented on humans. That is exactly what Israel is doing. They experiment on humans with these weapons, with these systems, and then they go around the world to weapons shows where they talk about how their equipment that they're selling is battle tested. And what they mean is, we've experimented on humans. We've massacred humans. And so we're going to see this for years now. It's one of the major Israeli exports is its weapon industry. Now this is going to come to a conflict near you. But it's state terrorism, I think, is all that it is ultimately, these AI programs.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We do a weekly column with our good friend Arun Gupta, who's a wonderful journalist who's been keeping an eye on the corporate media and on the way in which certain major stories are missed or undermined or used, really, by Israel in this context to prosecute a genocide. And I guess let's do some deconstructing here on our deconstructing segment. You said at the beginning of this segment that really media and corporate media has a lot, has to accept a lot of blame for being able to have this genocide be sustained by the United States and Israel. But deconstruct that a little bit. What do you mean? How do they have complaint? How do they actively undermine the information flow so that this kind of killing, this expansive genocide, can go on? And as you say, it's still considered an Israeli-Hamas war, or Hamas-Israeli war, whatever it is.
Well, yeah, right, exactly. That's one of the things, is just calling it an Israel-Hamas war is just a complete lie, and it allows Israel to continue it, rather than saying this is an all-out Israeli war on the Palestinian population. And it's no number of facts seems to change the corporate media's opinion, right? That's the whole absurdity with the strike on the World Central Kitchen convoy. You know, a convoy approved and coordinated with Israel, that Israel struck in three separate strikes, because there were three different vehicles over the course of, I believe, about a mile or so, give or take a little. You know, the first vehicle is struck, then the wounded are moved into the second vehicle.
Right.
It goes away, the second vehicle is struck.
They ran to the third vehicle.
They're moved into the third vehicle, and then the third vehicle is struck, and everyone is killed. And what a lot of people have been acting outraged about, especially Palestinians, is like, oh, the world finally cares when it's happening to white people, right, to when it's happening to Westerners. And the fact of the matter that thousands of Palestinians who have been killed, tens of thousands who have been killed, had nothing to do with the war, or like we've talked about, were healthcare workers, were civil defense workers, were professors, artists, intellectuals, you know, people, you know, great poets like Rafet Alair, you know, prominent physicists, authors, you know, who've been killed by Israel, you know, who had given the world so much, or had so much to give the world, or who were never allowed to give anything to the world, but instead it's all about, you know, these World Central Kitchen aid workers who, yes, they were heroic for going in there and for dying, unlike these genocidal soldiers that Israel is sending in there. But it's only about the white people, right? That's where the outrage comes. Where is the outrage over, I think it's now close to 200 UN personnel who've been killed in the Gaza Strip, over 100 Palestinian journalists who've been killed, you know.
140.
Right, and you know, all the outrage when Khashoggi was killed by you know, Mohammed Bonesaw, yeah, and the Saudis, you know, and where is the outrage over all the Palestinian journalists being killed? And it's this total dehumanization, and that's one thing we've been tracking since the beginning, right? The fact that the media were immediately they're barbarians, they're savages, they're inhumane, and the Israeli whole strategy of making Hamas, and therefore the Palestinians, equivalent to ISIS, and ISIS is so evil, they're Nazis, they're worse than Nazis, you know, that they have to be wiped out. And so the media have provided the framework, right? You cannot go to any sort of war without conditioning the public mindset. And so the media play the primary role in that. And in terms of being able to carry out genocide, which is the most extreme form of racism that exists, right? Because genocide is all about dehumanizing a people, making them legitimate, less than human, so they can be a legitimate target for extermination, and then carrying it out. It's all about creating the permissible mindset. And the media are completely, they are soaked in blood, all the media, corporate media, yeah, for this. And they should absolutely all have to stand trial for their crimes.
And it's, you know, and I hate to say it, or I don't know, but it's the liberal media, it's the MSNBC now. They've really created a situation, a network where they've turned journalism into stenography. And even many people who listen to this show, you know, take them very seriously. And, you know, they now have, what, three? They have the former press secretary of the vice president, Democrat, president, Democrat. You know, they have the entire staff of the Democratic Party on MSNBC. And you really get the impression that journalism is stenography. The State Department says it. We repeat it, and then we let them repeat it. And that's, or he should. On the one hand, they did. On the other hand, they did. But we don't have a clue about what really happened. Let's move onward.
Well, we know for a fact that CNN was running all of its material through the Jerusalem Bureau, the CNN Jerusalem, right, Bureau, which operates under military censorship. So we know that everything on CNN was basically IDF propaganda, because it couldn't go on unless the IDF approved it. And the first few months of this war, one of the things I was tracking was how the media were reporting, and much of the bombing occurred in the first 6 weeks, right? It's before the ceasefire, where 15,000 were killed, plus I think at that point, the ceasefire started on November 24th, around then, and there were 15,000 killed. And by early December, a week later, there was also an estimate of 8,000 missing under rubble and presumed dead, right? So that death count in those first 6 weeks or so was about 3,000 or 4,000 a week, and yet the media, the way they were reporting it, was a person they would not say that Israel killed them unless Israel said that they killed them. You know, that you would see all these articles where they were like, you know, they were, you know, that the Israeli military has been asked to comment on this strike. And, you know, they said they're looking into it, or there's been no response, or they're evaluating it, right? So that's why, again, on social media, you would see people criticizing all these passive headlines, you know, like 15,000 killed in conflict so far, and people would be like, who killed them? There's no agent. Again, it's conditioning people's mindset like this is some sort of earthquake, and it's just some tragedy that happened, just like the famine now, that, you know, it's not Israeli made famine, Israeli designed famine. Israel said it was going to do this, right? Yoav Gallant, the defense minister,
they said
they're human animals. We're going to cut off their food, fuel, water, electricity, medicine. We're going to treat them like human animals because that's what they are, right? Even when Israel says it, the media doesn't report it. And even with the World Central Kitchen, it's astonishing. I'm looking at these reports, like from the Associated Press, where it's like World Central Kitchen blames Israel for strike. The thing is, Israel has completely admitted it. And yet they're still saying, they're still making it sound like, you know, it's just accusation, just
it's
an allegation.
And it works. Boy, it works. It can sustain a genocide, and everybody learns how not to believe what they see, but how they're directed. We've got to leave it right there. Arun, as always, we're grateful for the Deconstructing Warlandia weekly segment with you, and we will talk to you next week. Please keep an eye on things for us.
Thank you, and if I may add, subscribe to my Substack, Arun Gupta, Life, the Universe, and Most Things. That's the name of it. And talk to you next week, Dennis.
Thank you. Thank you. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to continue this dialogue. We're going to be joined by Richard Silverstein of Tikkun Olam. We're going to keep talking about what is clear to me is the use of artificial and intelligence in automated warfare. And once again, the Palestinians seem to be the experimental people being used as targets in this new warfare. Stay with us.
She was a sleeper, glad you found a dreamer. Boring life is sweeter, but bitter between them. Moved out of the city, got your love a ring. She told you it was pretty, and that was the. Sleeper, sold you the dream and bought it to please her.
listening to Flashpoints on KPFA Pacifica Radio here in the San Francisco Bay Area. We broadcast every weekday from 5 to 6, and we are happy to have you along. We welcome back a regular contributor to this show, Richard Silverstein. He writes on security and other issues at Tikkun Olam and many other places. He's been doing great work with us, for us, helping us understand better things going on in terms of Israel-Palestine, and he does a good job covering the Israeli side. Welcome back, Richard. There's a couple of things I want to talk about. We're going to get to automated warfare, which is the absolute mind blower. But let's start. I have to admit, I'm a bit skeptical. We're hearing out of Washington, the conversation between Biden and Bibi was, Biden was tough. He actually started to take some action. Not sure you're going to help us understand what those real actions are, and what you see as the significance of this latest conversation between the two presidents. Do you think it's different? Does it signal something different? Do you see something that you might be able to hold on to, we could hold on to?
I think so. This White House conversation between Biden and Netanyahu, the president offered the strongest, sternest words that he has ever done since 10/7, when the attack on Israel happened. He demanded concrete steps that Israel take to protect not only aid workers, but also Gazans who are trying to receive the aid. He demanded an immediate ceasefire. This is a fight that we've been having for 3-4 months with Biden, for him to demand an immediate ceasefire. Two UN Security Council vetoes of resolutions saying this. So this is really a major move in the U.S. position. In addition, he told Netanyahu that to just get his act together, get a deal with Hamas. Israel has refused to do a deal that would free its hostages in return for the northern Gaza refugees to return to their homes. Israel has balked at agreeing to that, and Biden said to him, get it done. Another reason that is interesting is that at a meeting with Muslim Americans, Biden told the people at the gathering that his wife told him, stop it, Joe, just stop it. So it appears that spouses have more influence with their presidents, who are their husbands, than senior advisors do. But I'm just happy that they have any influence to make this type of thing happen. Now, in terms of what the repercussions could be, the U.S. could halt weapons exports to Israel if Israel doesn't do what he said. And my impression is that if Netanyahu balks, or there's another massacre like the World Central Kitchen aid workers, that that's the next step.
Well, we, you know, there really probably have been massacres already since, you know, the Israelis didn't stop bombing or killing. The killing machine continues. We're about to talk about that. So it doesn't look that bright on the ceasefire front, but it is troubling that on the day of the World Food attack, the United States sent over or made available 2,000 pound bunker busters and signed on to a sale for 50 fighter jets. I think we've talked about this before. That's a massive send. It's hard to back away. Do they have the weapons yet? Is it still time to not send those weapons, or are they there already?
Well, they're in the pipeline, so I think they're either on their way or they will be shortly. But let's point out that this is a pipeline that's gone all the way back to 10-7. So I have a feeling that this or perhaps certainly future weapons, plans for weapons exports, and possibly these will be slow-walked or either suspended, depending on what happens with Israel. And I also want to say, and we're going to get into this, I know, the World Central Kitchen killings of the 7 humanitarian aid workers really has been a game changer in all of this. It's what spurred Biden to ream out Netanyahu on that phone conversation. And the reason that it's so important and critical is that these were 7 foreign aid workers who were nationals of countries that are supporters of Israel, are Western European and democratic countries that have always had Israel's back, and now they've slaughtered the citizens of these countries, and the world cannot look away, which it has been doing for 6 months. Biden cannot look away, which he's been doing for 6 months. So this was the game changer.
All right, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Let's talk about the World Kitchen kill. Apparently, there's a bit of a blame game going on. A couple of officers, Israeli officers, were sacked. Do we know if they were fired or just transferred?
Well, my impression is that they were fired. The word in Hebrew that they use is usually the word for firing someone. So the officers that were fired were a brigade commander at the rank of colonel, and another officer with the rank of major, who was the number two in that brigade, and 3 senior officers, even more senior than those two, were issued reprimands, including the overall commander of all IDF forces in southern Israel, and who are the ones fighting in Gaza. So this is also unheard of from the IDF. I am not going to say that this is really any kind of transparency or accountability, because there is no such thing for the IDF and for Israel. But it's something more than they've ever done in similar situations. When they murdered Shirin Abu Akleh, the Al Jazeera correspondent and U.S. citizen, they did a sham investigation. No one was held accountable. In this case, it took them 72 hours to do an investigation, and they fired 2 senior officers and reprimanded 3 others. So this is a desperate response, a token attempt at accountability, or telling the world they're holding people accountable. But these 5 officers are not directly, and not to blame overall. Maybe they were responsible in some direct way for what happened, but it's the whole entire system that is at fault, the genocide that's at fault, the decisions on what targets to strike is at what fault. The IDF itself as an institution is at fault. And I know we're going to get into the artificial intelligence issue, but that works into this, because human beings are hardly making the decisions about who are attacked. So let's move into that if you want to do.
Okay. All right. Well, let's let people know you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And we're speaking with Richard Silverstein. He blogs at Tikkun Olam. He covers issues Israel-Palestine and has been helping us out since this latest version of the expanding genocide that is taking place now against Palestine. Now, there is this revelations, Yuval Abraham, this is an Israeli journalist, out of the publication, was it Plus 972, released this story, read a little bit of blockbuster story about how basically the Israeli military used a new artificial intelligence program known as Lavender to develop a kill list for the Gaza Strip. The kill list includes as many as 37,000 dozen Palestinians who were targeted for assassination with minimal human oversight. A second AI system known as Where is Daddy tracked Palestinians who appeared on the kill list. This was conceived and designed to assist Israel in targeting individuals when they were at home at night with their families. The targeting systems combined with an extremely permissive bombing policy in the Israeli military led to entire Palestinian families being wiped out. We remember that, don't we? Inside their houses. So this is a mighty powerful story. Again, it's Yuval Abraham, Israeli journalist, filmmaker, I believe, also. Are we seeing now the first sort of automated warfare? What is the significance of this story and these systems as they're now being used against the Gaza Strip?
Well, Israel is a pioneer in the use of advanced technology and weaponry and warfare, because it's essentially a garrison state in a state of perpetual war with its neighbors, its Arab neighbors, including Palestinians in West Bank and Gaza. So it's developed drones and targeted killing. It's developed cyber warfare technology that uses malware to intercept phone conversations and email from targets, whether they be Arabs of frontline countries or Palestinians. And now they've developed algorithms, artificial intelligence, which gives them a kill list based on the criteria that human beings transmit to the algorithm. So the algorithm is set up to look for human beings in certain parameters, and then it just goes on its merry way and gives you 35 or 37,000 individuals that it can target. Now, it can also target buildings. It can target anything that is in Gaza. And for example, 5 of the 7 universities in Gaza have been demolished, have been obliterated. Hospitals, there's only 1 or 2 hospitals out of 35 that existed that are able to provide any care. So these targets are the ones that Lavender and Where's Daddy is producing, almost like a printout that you would get on a computer program with a list of all of them, the coordinates where they are, and then the drone operators just go to work and take off the people who have been assassinated. And there's so many really interesting and shocking things in this report you mentioned. One of them is the targeting officers who get the list, the drone operators who've killed all the people on the list, come back to them and said, we need more, get us more. So how much evaluation is done by human beings in terms of choosing these targets? The algorithm is controlling the entire operation. The human being who looks at the target list has 20 seconds to approve the target. There is no research, there is no coordination, nothing at all. You just give the coordinates to the drone operator or whoever's going to be doing the killing, and they go ahead and they do it. So this is automated warfare run amok. And the problem with this, besides the killing of 33,000 Gazans, is that Israel's pioneering of all of these weapons of death will be exported to all of the countries that themselves are involved in warfare, hostilities, or civil war. These are now products. And in fact, the commander of Unit 82, which is the main intelligence unit in the IDF, wrote a book boasting about the capability of Lavender. And he self-published the book on Amazon. It's available to this day. And he wrote it 1 or 2 years ago. And researchers used the information in his book to actually identify him. He's one of the most secret officers in the IDF, and now we know that his name is, I think it's Yitzhak Sariel. So lavender is a prime export product for Israel to countries around the world, and it will be exporting not just the product, but it will be exporting the ability to kill around the world. And some people talk about AI warfare as protecting human beings, but this is false. We can see that AI has helped to kill 33,000 Gazans. It has vastly increased the lethality of warfare.
Wow. Again, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Richard Silverstein. Let's spend the last couple of minutes on something we were talking about last time that is of grave concern, and that is what is clearly a spreading regional war. The Israelis are bracing. They've put all leave on hold. All their military leaves are on hold. Now everybody's bracing. They know there's going to be a response to their attack on the Iranian embassy in Syria. These new weapons, that's the thing about the new weapons, including the 50 fighter jets. I mean, they don't need them for the Gaza Strip. This is for the bigger war. Are we moving quickly in that direction? Are you concerned that this is not letting up, that this is only getting worse?
Well, Israel has proven itself more than willing to escalate the conflict. It has assassinated Iranian generals, and two generals were among those killed in the bombing in Damascus of the Iranian consulate, and a Hezbollah officer was also killed in that attack. And so Israel does use the F-35s and the F-15s to carry out those attacks, but they could use them in a much more dangerous operation if Israel decided to attack Iran directly. And Israel has air bases in Azerbaijan, which borders on Iran. So all they have to do is send the planes to Azerbaijan, fuel them up, and they go and they could attack Iran. There are obviously constraints in doing that, but it will really depend on how Iran responds to this. If Iran does something that is very, I'm trying to think of the right word, is
audacious.
Audacious and shocking to Israel. Say they are able to kill an Israeli general or kill an Israeli politician or something along those lines, or there is some kind of terror attack, well, resistance attack on the part of the Iranians where Israelis are killed. All that could send Israeli jets to Iran. And we also have Iran-aligned Iraqi militias. They are the ones who fired the drone that bombed an Israeli Navy base in Eilat, which led to that attack in Damascus. So this is a tit-for-tat cold war that, or I don't know if you want to call it a warm war, but it could easily lead to a hot war. And you mentioned the call-up of the reserves. That's particular Air Force personnel were called up, and the defense minister is warning about a looming war with Hezbollah. So it won't take much. It won't take more than a small spark to set off a seven-party, potentially, war in the Middle East.
Okay, we have a couple of minutes left. Let's turn it back to Israel. What's going on in Israel now? Is Netanyahu in any real danger? Seems like they were trying to, they couldn't stay away. They're trying to break into the parliament. Does that mean anything at this point in terms of what's happening? How would you put it in the mix?
I think it's an important background story. The hostage families have been demonstrating in front of the Prime Minister's house, demanding a hostage deal, and that serves as a strong vote of no confidence in Netanyahu. They feel abandoned by the government, and they feel that their loved ones are being ignored and erased by the leadership of Israel. So what they did was they invaded a Knesset committee meeting, and they began to shout so that they couldn't do any business. And then they went to the Knesset itself during a parliamentary session, and in the visitors gallery they again started screaming, and the color of the hostage campaign is yellow, and so they brought yellow paint and they were smearing the paint on the glass walls of the visitors gallery. And you see the police, the security guards coming and wrestling the hostage families and dragging them physically out of the visitors gallery. And these are scenes that have to shock Israelis, who naturally, I think, have some sympathy with the hostages. And this, coordinated with Bibi's demand that Netanyahu get a deal done in Doha with Hamas, get the hostages free, and get the Gazans back to northern Gaza, that's the context in which the hostage family movement has an impact.
All right. Well, we thank you again for taking the time out. We're going to keep an eye on it. People can follow your work at Tikkun Olam. That's where you blog and write. It's a wonderful website for information on this crucial story. And I tell you that automation and warfare, computerized warfare, the machines calling the shots in 20 seconds, and as you point out, now this is sort of part of Israel's export industry, so we're going to be seeing this expand in this kind of warfare. This is it. Here we are. Welcome to the 21st century. Stay safe, Richard. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, Dennis. Go on.
And we'll talk to you. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. You can check me out at dennis@kpfa.org. I'd love to hear from you. What do you think about all this? What do you think about all this? Let us know. Welcome.
That wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
David Barsamian of